Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has testified in a public Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. What did he say? Donald Trump celebrates his 71st birthday as a political civil war continues to engulf Washington. We take a look at a life marked by extreme bigotry, extreme privilege, and dumb luck. The diplomatic crisis among Gulf monarchies continues to develop rapidly. Qatar has hired George W. Bush's Attorney General John Ashcroft as its lawyer and for, quote, crisis response. What's next in the rift in the Gulf? But first, we turn to the Jeff Sessions hearings in Washington. We are joined from Seattle by Jane Cutter. She is the editor of LiberationNews.org website. And from Baltimore, Maryland, by Kevin Zeese, the co-director of Popular Resistance. That's PopularResistance.org. Welcome back, Jane and Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Brian.
Kevin Zeese, to quote Shakespeare, much ado about nothing. What did you think about the testimony by Jeff Sessions?
Yeah, much ado about nothing is a good way to describe it. This is the Russiagate story, really. There's so much innuendo and inadequate proof of claims being made, you know, from the beginning to end. And Jeff Sessions in his testimony really just continued that. There was no meeting at the Mayflower Hotel, the third meeting, supposedly, that people were accusing. It didn't happen. His previous discussions with the Russian ambassador were not substantive. They were kind of brief meetings, it sounds like, that didn't discuss anything about the elections in the United States as far as Russia taking any kind of actions. And so this has become a partisan show. We've seen Democrat-related nonprofits organizing protests around the country calling for investigations. We already have a special counsel, Robert Mueller, conducting an investigation. And I have criticisms of Mueller. That's a separate question, which maybe we'll have time to get into. But really, so far, there's not much really to go on. And you can see Mueller's investigation moving away from Russiagate and more toward obstruction of justice, which I don't see that much there either, frankly, at this point. Maybe more will come out, but so far, not much.
Jane Cutter, you know, the Trump administration right now in the last weeks has tried to lift all of the protections that would help safeguard the environment. They're trying to get rid of Medicaid, trying to get rid of that part of the Affordable Care Act that had many advantages, including the expansion of Medicaid. In other words, a plan that would deprive 24 million Americans of health care coverage over the next 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Immigration raids, mass roundups of immigrants. I mean, just a lot to protest against Donald Trump. And yet the Democrats are really almost entirely focused on a campaign that seems to have no there there. I mean, you had Jeff Sessions recused himself as attorney general from the Russia investigation. Last week, James Comey, the now fired FBI director, said during his testimony before the same Senate committee that Sessions testified, quote, "We also were aware of facts that I cannot discuss in an open setting that would make his," that's Jeff Sessions, "continued engagement in a Russia-related investigation problematic. So we were convinced, and in fact, I think that we'd already heard that the career people were recommending that he recuse himself, that he was not going to be in contact with Russia-related matters much longer, and that turned out to be the case. Now, it seemed to me that that's the thing, Jane, that really made Jeff Sessions want to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee, basically to defend his own name. I mean, there's not much else that came out of yesterday's hearings.
That's right. And before I go further into it, I just want to make one thing perfectly clear. Jeff Sessions is a vile, bottom-feeding racist. Let there be no confusion about that. But as far as these accusations, right, it's nothing but innuendo. And the most they could get out of him was he attended a, as a member of a, an advisor to a campaign, he attended a reception. And then they got into a long, drawn out, it seemed like they were talking about how many angels could dance on the head of executive privilege. And they kind of went back and forth about that for a long time. But, you know, I really almost got sick to my stomach at the beginning when Sessions was pontificating about defending the democratic process and for the importance of protecting the democratic process from things that would attack it, because he has a long, career-long history of seeking to undermine the voting rights of African Americans.
Yeah, Kevin Zeese, that's so true. I mean, let's help the audience also remember that when Jeff Sessions was nominated by Ronald Reagan to be a federal district court judge in Alabama, he couldn't even get through the Senate at that time because of his overt anti-black racist comments. And then he's been the chief xenophobe, anti-immigrant sort of cheerleader while he's been a U.S. senator from Alabama. And now leading, again, these terrible ICE raids. I mean, these vicious raids that are arresting people who have been in the United States 30, 35 years, breaking up families, arresting grandfathers. I saw this, these Iraqi-American grandfathers who were being busted in Detroit in the last couple of days because they had a minor violation from 30 years ago. That's Jeff Sessions. But that's not what the Democrats in the Senate are going after Jeff Sessions for. I mean, it really is, did you meet with the ambassador? Did you fail to tell your colleagues that you met with the ambassador? Of course, the Russian ambassador to Washington meets with high-level U.S. senators all the time. I mean, it is fundamentally routine. And yet now any contact with Russians, I saw the New York Times had a had an article that says Trump's advisors' ties to Russia the other day. It was seven of them. Roger Stone's ties that they could cite was that he had a Twitter connection with an online Russian blah, blah, blah oligarch or something.
That's right. No, you're exactly right. And like Jane, I'm not a fan of Jeff Sessions. That's for sure. He's kind of the opposite of what I would stand for if I was Attorney General. And I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but he's doing many things wrong. But this is a diversion from debating those issues. And I think the Democrats are diverting because they are the minority in both houses, and they have very little power. What this Russiagate investigation accomplishes for the Democrats is it ties Trump up in a very big side issue that's required him to hire lawyers, required members of his administration to hire lawyers, requires his daily attention. You know, there's only a certain amount of time in the day. If you're focused on defending yourself on these false allegations, or these allegations without any factual basis so far, we don't know they're false yet, but so far I don't see anything. It just, you know, sucks up his time and makes it impossible for him to do his job. And maybe that's a good thing that he can't do his job, because what he would be doing, we'd be all disagreeing with. And so I think the Democrats are using this as a strategy. But I think it's a dangerous strategy, because in the end, maybe they'll get Michael Flynn on not reporting some income. You know, maybe they'll get, you know, another one or two members of the campaign, you know, to, you know, on minor charges, not reporting various things, not registering as a foreign agent or something. But there'll be minor charges. And in the end, the Democrats will look like they were playing partisan games with a very important issue. Russia is an important country. You know, they are a major economy the size of Germany. They are a nuclear armed country. They play major roles in key parts of the world, Syria, Iran, and other nations. They say, and so creating conflict with Russia over false allegations or unproven allegations of them trying to undermine our elections is damaging. It's damaging to the world and to our foreign policy. So I find it to be this whole thing to be a shameless diversion that is taking us away from really confronting the issues that both Trump and Sessions are putting forward. I worry about Sessions. He now has a secret group talking about how to undermine the progress being made on marijuana policy. And so we can start to see more arrests in Colorado and other states if that goes the direction it seems to be going. On issue after issue, Sessions is wrong. But the Congress, the Democrats need to find a way to stand up to him in Congress, debate those issues, win those issues. But the problem is the Democrats just are not that good on these issues. They, you know, on health care, they are afraid to say improved Medicare for all is our policy, even though more than half the Democrats in the House have signed on to John Conyers' expanded and improved Medicare for all bill. Pelosi's trying to push it back to the states, which is a counterproductive move to actually achieving the goal. So the Democrats don't want to stand for anything because they're afraid to stand for something. And so for them, it's much better to wrap Trump up in these unproven allegations.
That's an excellent point. Jane, you know, when the Democrats did have control of the House, which they did in 2009 and 2010, they had the control of the Senate by big majorities in the Senate and the House, and they had a popular president, Barack Obama. They could do anything that they wanted to do. Nothing could stop them at that time. And they did do what they wanted to do, which was to pass the Affordable Care Act, which was to give, you know, private insurance companies another, I don't know, 20 or 30 million people who had to pay them money and taxpayers who had to subsidize these private insurance companies. There were some advances, but it wasn't Medicare for all. They could have done that then. And so now you have the situation where the Democrats are focusing the liberal public attention against the crime of wanting to have good relations with Russia, which is now called colluding with Russia, because there's no evidence that there was actual Russian meddling. Maybe there was, but there hasn't been any hard proof given. We have a situation where James Comey said he was, when he met with Trump the first time in January 6, 2016, right after the election, right before Trump became president, he was the one who cleared the room of all other people, and he told Trump about the salacious details of a so-called, you know, Trump was with hookers or something in Moscow, and he said Trump wasn't under personal investigation. Like, he said that to Trump. Then Trump cleared the room the next time he wanted to talk to Comey, and he cleared the room, and that was a few weeks later. And then suddenly Comey is saying, I didn't feel secure being around Donald Trump. I had to memorialize all of my interactions with Donald Trump. And yet all Trump was actually asking Comey to do was to leak the news that Trump wasn't under personal investigation. I mean, it seems to me that Trump made a huge political error by firing Comey. He completely miscalculated. He thought Comey's firing would be applauded by the Democrats because the Democrats hated Comey, too, until now when they love Comey. I mean, it seems to me just the Democrats are doing everything, as Kevin said, to dodge the real issue and create false. This is a false issue.
Well, absolutely. I couldn't agree more, Brian. And if the Democrats were in Congress were actually truly representing the interests of the people of this country, they would be fighting against everything that Sessions is actually doing as Attorney General. They would be fighting for the rights of the undocumented. They would be fighting for immigrant rights. They would be fighting they'd be fighting against Trump. They'd be fighting to truly expand Medicaid for all. And instead, like you said, they're focusing on this false issue. And all of a sudden, like you said, they love Comey. And so let's not forget exactly who Comey and the FBI are, which are horrible criminals who have committed numerous crimes against the people going back for generations. They have undermined the democratic process in this country and the civil liberties and civil rights of countless people. And they are no heroes, no principled leaders, the way that all of a sudden Comey has turned into this hero.
We're just about out of time. Kevin, I want to ask you a follow-up question along the lines of what Jane is talking about. You were one of the principal leaders of the Occupy movement in Washington, D.C. at Freedom Plaza. That was Mueller, who was the FBI director at that time. They did everything to shut down Occupy. 7,000 people were arrested. He did a lot of other things like rounding up Muslims after September 11th. And yet now you have fake movement groups like Move On, which is really just a front for the Democratic Party. Unlike the genuine grassroots resistors, they're now acting like Comey and Mueller are these great bastions and guardians of democracy.
And that's the big danger, because now Mueller has license. I mean, he has power, he has budget, he has FBI investigators, he has lawyers. He's hiring a bunch of lawyers who donated to the Hillary Clinton campaign. And he has the power now to take this where he wants. Remember Whitewater, the Clinton investigation, was a land deal and ended up as a sex in the White House investigation. We don't know where Mueller's going to take this. And so this could go on for 2 years. It could meander to whole different issues, more scandals, more diversions, and we don't know where it's going to end up. And that's very dangerous, I think, that the FBI now and the Department of Justice has a independent special counsel who can take this anywhere. It's very dangerous. And Mueller has a terrible record on post 9/11, on helping to build up the false intelligence to go to war in Iraq, on anthrax, where he made a false arrest, cost the United States $5 million in damages, on rounding up 1,100 Muslims after 9/11, on infiltrating peace groups and infiltrating the Occupy movement and other movements along the way. This is not someone we trust. This is not someone who has ethics. This is someone who sells out and protects the ruling elites. That's what he's done his whole career. And the ruling elites right now, they've been wanting this for more than the Trump era, going back to Obama and even Mitt Romney's campaign. They've wanted conflict with Russia.
Jane Cutter, we'll give you the last word in 45 seconds or so. Where does it go? And what do the people who are resisting, like you, who are the grassroots resistance against Trump, I mean, what are you doing right now? How do you differentiate from this phony, false, reactionary, I would say right-wing resistance against Trump that's being carried out in Congress?
Well, I'm planning on going to the People's Congress of Resistance in Washington, D.C. on September 16th and 17th, and I hope other people who are in the resistance, the true resistance, will go there too, because I think we all need to meet up with each other and formulate a real program and a strategy of resistance that's going to be effective and not get sidestepped by all these diversions.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think Kevin's right. Following the Democrats right now is following Mueller, following Comey. That's just plain dangerous for progressive people, because following them means they can take you all kinds of places that will ultimately be the opposite of something progressive. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been speaking with Kevin Zeese and Jane Cutter. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump celebrates his 71st birthday today. As a political civil war continues to engulf Washington, D.C., we take a look at a life marked by extreme bigotry, extreme privilege, and maybe just dumb luck. We are joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga, the host of the weekly show The Way with Anoa, and she is also the deputy director of MPACT. And from Florida by Ben Weaver, also known as Ben America. He is the political director of MPACT. Welcome back, Anoa, and welcome, Ben.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Glad to be here.
Great. Thanks so much for joining. Anoa Chenga, I was looking at a Ted Rawls' graphic biography of Donald Trump, and it says, everyone in America thought they knew Donald Trump. The real estate magnate, reality TV star, and bigger-than-life personality lived his life in the tabloids. Little did they know, though, as he hinted at repeatedly, that he planned to take American politics by storm. Well, that certainly did happen. Donald Trump, with the great, great, great assistance of the mainstream media, which made him a thing, is now the president of the United States. When you think about Donald Trump, the man, what do you think about?
I think that's absolutely right, Brian. When folks have probably thought about Donald Trump, I've thought about, you know, basically Biff from Back to the Future, right? Some, you know, larger-than-life billionaire with, you know, extravagant tendencies and shooting off at the mouth. Not someone to be seriously taken seriously on the political scene. And certainly not someone who would be leading the alleged free world, even though it seems like the free world is now revolting against American leadership under, you know, his presidency. Now, when I think about Donald Trump, I think about someone that is still a quagmire of, I don't know, various eccentricities. But I don't know that I quite expected him to operate entirely the way he has during this election cycle, and even, you know, now actually in terms of quote-unquote running the country. But it is definitely a very convoluted and interesting presidency and legacy he's beginning to build in the political world.
Ben, I know, is absolutely right. I mean, nobody could have actually predicted how he would operate, but let's look at how he operated. I mean, the moment he came into office, he tried to fulfill his campaign pledge to ban Muslims. He tried to put a legal fig leaf on it saying it wasn't a ban on all Muslims. It was just a ban on 7 majority Muslim countries. That made tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people take to the streets, go to airports, occupy airports, and eventually both the federal district court and then the appeals court ruled that that was unconstitutional. He said he would get rid of the Affordable Care Act. That's just become a gigantic explosion within the Republican Party because they can't agree on how to get rid of it. Then he had the firing of James Comey, the FBI director, who he thought everybody would applaud the firing of Comey because the Democrats hated Comey too much. I mean, he's got a lot of problems. He's got a lot of enemies, obviously, both at the grassroots and within the summits of the Washington establishment. But Donald Trump is an unusually bad political leader, and it seems like he's just maybe not having as much fun as he predicted he would be having.
If white supremacy could bear offspring, it would look like Donald Trump. From his hair to his management style, he represents all of the things that are wrong with the way that our country glorifies greed. And it glorifies, it labels success as the exploitation of other people. And having seen what he's done since he's been in the White House, he's demonstrated that. He's demonstrated privilege, and he's demonstrated a worldview that is isolationist. And it's not just isolationist as it relates to our foreign policy, it's isolationist domestically. And the danger with that is that as we begin to isolate ourselves and individualize ourselves more, we lose that power that America was built on, which was our ability to collectively work together to create great things.
I know Donald Trump is the son of Fred Trump. He was a, quote, business success. He was also a racist. He made sure not to rent or sell to black or Latino people in New York City. Donald Trump had a blessed youth. I mean, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. His father left him an inheritance worth either $40 million or up to $200 million. Then in the 1990s, Donald Trump went basically bankrupt until 70 banks bailed him out. And then he was just considered a mid-level real estate mogul loser until he became the head of or the show host of The Apprentice. Again, a show organized by Fred Zucker, now news producer or central CEO at CNN. He was brought back to life by the same people who are now crucifying him at CNN. And again, it seems to be all about business.
Yeah, I mean, I really do think, just following what Ben said and what you just pointed out, I mean, I really do think this also shows like the problem over the last 20, 30 years with the nature of the way business has been done in terms of the financial industry as well as the news/entertainment industry, because so much of our news is carefully curated to evoke certain reactions and emotions and not necessarily just to inform. So although we slam Fox News for being just really just like some perverse type of entertainment, I mean, really when we look at the way CNN and MSNBC have been increasingly curated a certain way, I mean, arguably the same thing can be said for those outlets and others as well. I mean, we've talked about this before, Brian, with the head of CBS saying, you know, Donald Trump was good for ratings. I mean, the way that news programs have now been ratings-driven, maybe this was always like this, but it seems like, particularly in the past 5 years or so, it really has been a greater increase in news programming delivering high ratings and making money, which then lends to having outlandish and outrageous folks like a Donald Trump be the ones to get the attention and focus. The other thing that you touched on in terms of his upbringing, being New York, being a racist, you know, his father being a racist, him. What's really interesting is it's not that, you know, we only know these things now in the modern era because of, you know, social media and Google and technology and stuff. Like, this is not stuff that was hidden. This is not stuff that was unknown in the 80s and 90s about Donald Trump. I mean, when he took out that ad in all those papers against Central Park 5, so everybody knew exactly who Donald Trump was and what he was doing. And yet, political elites, like within the Democratic Party, like the Clintons, even, you know, the who's who of hip hop and other folks, did still choose to engage with him because we have a tendency, and I say we euphemistically, just Americans in general, have a tendency of excusing, you know, the behaviors of the rich, of folks like Donald Trump, as just being eccentric or outlandish, or just as people excuse Bill Maher for being, oh, well, what he said is bad, but he talks badly about everybody. And that's a similar type of way that people dismiss Donald Trump. Donald Trump says whatever he wanted to say, but he said whatever he wanted to say about all types of issues across the board. So it was excused for decades. And so we now have him as not only the leading contender for president, but now actually as the president of the United States of America. He is the Frankenstein built by Democrats who took money from him and associated with him, by political and other social elites who allowed him to exist, and by the news networks and the networks in general that gave him space and time for the last however many years, even before he ran for president.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. In early 1989, Trump took out a full-page ad in the Daily News, that's a leading New York City tabloid, about the Central Park jogger case in which five young black men were charged with carrying out a brutal rape of a white woman who was jogging through Central Park. It turned out none of it was true. They were forced to confess by police brutality. They were very, very young. And Trump took out a full-page ad calling for their execution. Of course, later they were exonerated. And he wrote in that full-page ad, "How can our great society tolerate the continued brutalization of its citizens by crazed misfits? Criminals must be told that," and this is all caps, "their civil liberties end when an attack on our safety begins." And then it's the headline was, "Bring back the death penalty, bring back our police." Okay, so that's the same message, Ben, that Trump is doing in the 2016 election campaign, calling Mexicans rapists, calling immigrants, undocumented folks who are working here as a bunch of criminals, saying that we have to build a beautiful wall like Israel's wall against the Palestinians along the Mexican border and make Mexico pay for it. And also, of course, the extreme misogyny where the tapes came out where Donald Trump has talked, obviously bragging about sexually assaulting women and how he can do it because he's rich and famous. And yet CNN, CBS, all of them gave Trump nonstop 24/7 coverage like it was great recreation. This would have sunk any other candidate, but this was a different – we're in a different ballgame.
Trump spoke to the fetishes of the right wing, and he spoke about those issues nonstop. When he was pulled off of message, he would pivot back to those fetish points, and he would hit those again and again and again. And he would say these lines in a time where politically correct language is being treated as something that ties down the individual. And it's a natural course of events. His message speaking to the right wing that wanted to see their idea of society return, this Leave It to Beaver concept of what society used to be, it was really driven by fantasy in the first place. He is a fantastic candidate in terms of he is based in fantasy. His support really is also based in fantasy. We're seeing it wash away now. And what we will find in the long run is that we will look back on this and see what happens when the politicians and the people that are supposed to be representing and are supposed to be doing the work, the service, the public service, when they give up that obligation to get power and to enrich themselves, then they create an environment where a charlatan can step in and just create a complete fantasy, and people are more willing to believe in that than what is real.
Anoa Chenga, I want to ask you about the Democrats, because Donald Trump is making outrageous mistakes. He's shooting himself in the foot over and over again. He even challenged the outcome of the U.S. election that he won. I mean, it's so odd. I mean, he actually lost the popular vote by 3 million but won the electoral vote. But then he went on and on and on about how if it hadn't been for voter fraud, he would have won the popular vote, too. In other words, he's such an extreme narcissist that the fact that he won the election but lost the popular vote meant that he had to create these fictions, and they are fictions. There weren't 3 million fraudulent votes. When you see the whole thing unfold, and it's almost every day, obviously Donald Trump could be, you know, really taken to task for almost anything. The Democratic Party could very well take him to task because he's destroying any protections for environmental regulations, anything that inhibits the extreme maximization of profit. He's destroying the environment. He's loaded his cabinet with oligarchs, right-wing oligarchs and generals. He's carrying out the destruction of health care for millions of Americans. He's trying to take food stamps away from people or charge people who use food stamps a higher fee, in other words, another tax, just to get food. And at the same time, the Democratic Party has decided to focus on the Russia connection with Trump rather than all of these social and economic and environmental issues, which are actually affecting millions of people. So in a way, this theater, and that's what it really is, this theater is really playing itself out daily, where Trump becomes, again, sort of useful for the Democratic Party. And they even cheered when the Republican health care plan was passed by the House, and they were hoping that it would work against Trump, even though it actually, if passed, would mean millions of people would lose health insurance. That really didn't matter to them. This is a circus. What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely agree. Particularly now, you know, everyone cheered when that when the Senate refused to take up the House version of the, what is it, the AHCA or whatever they're calling it. And now, you know, their draft is being released and it's like just as, you know, disturbing. So it would be great to see the Democrats, you know, really like rally around some of these very strong points. You do have some folks talking about Medicare for all, but it's certainly not enough. There are some murmurings that Senate Dems are willing to kind of go easier in terms of health care because they want bipartisan support in terms of the Russia investigation. And it's like, again, you know, Nina Turner spoke on this maybe a couple of weeks ago, like, yes, you know, investigate, determine if there really was some type of, you know, improper behavior. I mean, because it's really unacceptable if, you know, the head of the country has engaged in inappropriate behavior with, you know, leaders of other nations to undermine, you know, democracy and voter integrity. However, we have a systemic history of both parties undermining democracy and voter integrity through our election process. And if they're really serious about concerned about democracy and voter integrity, we would really see a more robust attitude and approach to, and not just this little commission or whatever they're creating to respond to Trump's voter integrity commission led by now gubernatorial candidate from Kansas, Kris Kobach, but like a real serious effort to address the aging voter system that we have in this country, as well as the millions who have been disenfranchised through cross-check voter ID rules that look at taking people off polls if they haven't voted in recent elections, all types of stuff. And Democrats are often silent. I'm actually meeting with a woman later today who started this group called, this organization called Spread the Vote, that's looking at addressing, you know, issues in terms of voter suppression. And one of the things that she said when she spoke at an event here in Georgia 3 weeks ago was that, you know, as a long-term Democrat, she went to Democratic Party where she was, and she was like, these issues are happening, you know, we need help. And they were silent. And she decided to start her organization because she knew that she couldn't rely on any particular party to do anything. And I think that's how people feel all across America. And folks are looking for leadership in this time. Everyone says work local or organize or whatever. And people are really looking for leaders, for voices to help them, you know, have some guidance and direction. And unfortunately, for the most part, Democrats are really falling down on the job. Trump is the absolute disaster. The Republicans have been a disaster since they took over the House and the Senate. You know, when the majority was lost in 2010, they've been a continuous disaster. Their approval ratings have been lower than Democrats, and yet they continue to still beat them because Democrats have not unified around a real message that resonates with American people. And they're not organizing. They're not leading. They're just pointing fingers and whining about how Bernie is overstaying his welcome in the Democratic Party.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We are completely out of time. We've been joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga, the host of the weekly show The Way with Anoa, and Deputy Director of MPACT, and from Florida by Ben Weaver, also known as Ben America. He is the Political Director of MPACT. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The diplomatic crisis among Gulf monarchies continues to develop rapidly. Qatar has hired George W. Bush's Attorney General John Ashcroft as its lawyer and for crisis response. What's next in this rift in the Gulf? We are joined from London by Masoud Shajarei. He is the co-founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Welcome back, Masoud.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining. John Ashcroft, well, we all remember John Ashcroft when he was the Attorney General after September 11th. He was the architect of what was called then and still called the Patriot Act, which was basically, I don't know, stripping the U.S. Constitution of any pretense towards democratic rights if the government so chose to rescind them. During the commencement of the so-called War on Terror, Ashcroft was right there, front and center with George W. Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. Now he's been hired by Qatar. Tell us what he's going to be doing.
Well, it really is very bizarre, you couldn't really write stories like that. It really is bizarre, the whole episode, that just after the visit of Trump into the region, we actually had this sort of conflict unleash in what was up to then, at least on the surface, sort of unity among the Gulf states. And now it's Qatar is trying everything. And on one side, Qatar feels threatened if U.S. really turns away from it. And it feels threatened by Saudi Arabia, which always have been. Qatar has over and over, even the father of President King was on the record as saying that one of the reasons allowed the United States to actually have bases in Qatar was because he was scared of invasion by the Saudis. And it seems that, again, this present sort of ruler is also looking to find solution to its difficulty and this blockade and sort of aggression against Qatar to United States. And it's actually going to pay millions to see if he could sort of buy favor or indeed have someone to maneuver some sort of support back to Qatar away from the Saudis. And I really don't know how realistic this is to sort of think that, getting someone from the sort of Republican sort of party will be influential in trying to actually open up some sort of way for Qatar into favor of Trump.
Yeah, it's kind of a perfect picture of modern day imperialism. The imperialists arm Saudi Arabia, they give them constant money, constant arms. They encourage their wars, like the war in Yemen. They are partners with Saudis. And then the Saudis do something like threaten Qatar. And the royal family in Qatar reaches back to one of the leading personages in the imperialist edifice and pays him a lot of money, $2.5 million to be friends. That's a flat fee to John Ashcroft, $2.5 million. He doesn't need a stipend. $2.5 million flat fee to cover his firm's first 90 days of expenses on the project, quote, given the urgent need to commence work. That's the language of this agreement between Ashcroft's law firm, between the law firm of the former U.S. Attorney General under George W. Bush and the Gulf monarchy, Qatar, to help it in its struggle against Saudi Arabia, again backed by the United States and backed by Donald Trump, who's congratulating them. He's actually taking full credit. He said afterwards, after he came back from Saudi Arabia and after this rift opened up, after Saudi Arabia tried to isolate Qatar, that he now knows that he could see the light at the end of the tunnel, that the world's struggle against terrorism was finally coming to an end. Now that Qatar is on the defensive and he, Donald Trump, did it. I mean, the whole thing, as you said, is surreal, but at the same time, a perfect image of sort of the decadence and the nature, the fundamental nature of modern imperialism.
Absolutely. And Donald Trump seems to be playing that sort of the role of very aggressive, very heartless businessman who is just seeing the whole of the sort of Gulf region as a possibility to make a buck or two and sort of basically clean up the sort of excess funds in Saudi Arabia and then Qatar and then getting them to start wars, strengthen wars, do more in Syria, do more in Yemen, do more against one another, and then possibly dragging Turkey into it, and etc. It really is bizarre, what in reality it means chaos, it means conflict, it means fueling old conflicts, and what it really means is suffering for ordinary people, not just in the Gulf state, but far beyond that. And I really think that this is playing with fire and actually creating a conflict further in that region where we know once you start a conflict, be it in Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or elsewhere, then to find a solution to it becomes impossible. You know, any fool could start a war and conflict. But, it takes a lot to actually try to find solutions afterward.
Indeed. Very easy to climb the escalation ladder, very hard to get off of it, because you can take each step unilaterally and then the other side will match you. But to get off the escalation ladder, to de-escalate, people have to move more or less at the same time, and that takes a lot of synchronization. Very, very hard. And that, as you said, Masoud, is the way bigger wars start. I want to talk about the other sort of geopolitical fallout of this development, Saudi Arabia trying to isolate Qatar. And of course, Saudi Arabia has the support of most of the other Gulf monarchies. Reuters reported last weekend, quote, Iran has sent 4 cargo planes of food to Qatar and plans to provide 100 tons of fruit and vegetable every day. Iranian officials said amid concerns of shortages after Qatar's biggest suppliers severed ties with the import-dependent country. Help the audience understand why Qatar is so vulnerable to a boycott. And also, does this show some kind of realignment between Iran and Qatar? Of course, that would have been something that would have been hard to have imagined a little while ago. At least I would have thought it would be. Maybe I don't know enough. Help us understand that.
One of the reasons Qatar is so vulnerable, Qatar hasn't got a facility for very large containers to actually to bring food and goods into it. And in past, it has gone to the Emirates and then offloaded there and then redirected with the smaller ships into Qatar. And currently, the Emiratis and the Saudis and everyone else is actually refusing to provide that services. And I believe only a couple of days ago, Oman offered to provide that service for Qatar. But again, Iran is just across the Gulf, and it's capable of providing and is capable of providing fresh food and so forth from the produce of Iran. And they have actually come forward to do so. I think what is really happening is that many people, including Qatar's and to some extent Oman, and to some extent Dubai Emirates, quite concerned, including Kuwaitis, are quite concerned of the aggressive style of the Saudis and their local politics and the way that they are pushing their weight around in that region and indeed trying to push that weight around within the Muslim world. And people feel quite vulnerable that if Qatar is dealt with, you know, it might be Kuwaitis next, or it might be Omanis next, or it could be, you know, already there is a conflict with Iran. And so as much as they don't want to be contributor to sort of fueling these conflict further, they're actually quite worried, and they don't want Qatar to be taken out in this way, which will give Saudis more power and more resources and more money and probably, you know, sort of resources of Qatar as well. So Iran's involvement in helping is quite sort of natural in, under these circumstances. But also we see that Turkey is offering a very useful and very positive helping hand, and indeed Oman and Kuwait have really refused to become party to Saudi's aggression and policy with regard to Qatar, and so is playing this role of mediation because doesn't want to actually take a side, and well, doesn't want to take the natural side of Saudis. So we are seeing realignment of some of the local governments and local countries. And I think that is very helpful to Iran and is very helpful to sort of trying to stop what some observers saying, the sort of the madness of the young prince in Saudi Arabia, and is sort of very aggressive militaristic sort of policies in the region.
Right. So Turkey's parliament approved a bill last week that would allow troops to deploy to Qatar, setting up a military base in the country in which 3,000 would initially be sent. Let's just spend another minute or so about the Turkey-Qatar relationship. You have Turkey and Iran, and now we know Iran is also helping Qatar in its struggle with Saudi Arabia. Turkey and Iran, along with Russia, at some point became the guarantors for the peace process in Saudi Arabia. That, of course, would not have been something that the United States would be very happy about. Turkey, of course, is a U.S. NATO ally, the eastern flank of NATO. Al Jazeera reported yesterday Russia's President Putin has also warned in a phone conversation with the King of Saudi Arabia that the blockade against Qatar by its neighbors would make it harder to reach a peaceful end to war in Syria. Putin and King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, quote, touched, this is Al Jazeera, touched on the aggravated situation around Qatar, which unfortunately does not help consolidate joint efforts in resolving the conflict in Syria and fighting the terrorist threat. Well, Saudi Arabia doesn't really want to resolve the conflict in Syria. But talk about how this realignment is shaking out. And is it, of course, everything seems to be not durable right now in that region. Everything that seems to come together sort of melts into the air. All the different alliances keep shifting. But is there a possibility of a genuine sort of long-term realignment, or is this just maneuver and shadow boxing?
Well, I think if we look at realignment of the sort of countries in the region, it started long before the current situation of Qatar. You really need to look back at the time of the coup in Turkey. If you remember when the coup took place, Russia's relationship with Turkey was very low and very negative. And then during that coup, it was very obvious that Russia actually helped Turkey. And it was observed that indeed it was warnings were given by Russia. And immediately the relationship between Turkey and Russia changed almost 180 degrees. And also at the same time, many observers were saying that this was also connected to the situation of Qatar, because Saudi Arabia was said to be involved directly or indirectly with the coup in Turkey. And it was actually thinking that once that coup takes place, then that will weaken Qatar, which has been relying on Turkey for a very long time. As a matter of fact, there is There is a sort of a military presence of Turkey in Qatar as a means of protecting Qatar against Saudi Arabia. So this realignment was there for quite some time, and some observers saying that this is also to do with the gas pipes going to go through through Syria and Turkey and so forth and so on. But the fact of the matter is that we have seen a sort of a gradual shift in realignment, and that has now been strengthened with the situation of Qatar. And it goes back to the whole issue that many people in the Middle East now look at young prince in Saudi Arabia as very aggressive, very arrogant, very sort of military reliant on any sort of policy rather than diplomacy, and their relationship with clear relationship with Israeli state. And the fact that it actually wants to be dominating the whole area as very aggressive and very unwarranted for the long-term tranquility and peace of not just Syria, Yemen, who are in midst of crisis, but the rest of the states, including Kuwait, Oman, and even places like Dubai and so forth.
All right, we have run out of time. We've been talking from London with Masoud Shajarey. He is the co-founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. You can follow their work at ihrc.org.uk. That's ihrc.org.uk. Thank you, Masoud. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.